All right, look, we're a bit behind, so I am going to start out with where with the Bors piece again, right? And get back to the question as to whether or not the idea of health and disease can be defined without referring to social norms or what are societal norms about what's desirable. That's what where we were last time, right? Okay. Anybody have any comments from last time? Is everything crystal clear? Yep. We'll test it once we have exams. All right, look. The point that I was trying to, the situation I was going to try to get to last time, and this should not come as a surprise, that there has been a tremendous effort in the last 70 or 80 years to try to make medicine more and more and more scientific, right? At one end, this means, well, it's a very good thing that back in the 18th century, there was a huge a change in medical practice in the Western world, starting in Europe, mainly in the Netherlands, and then it spreads to Edinburgh in England, which had probably the greatest medical school in the world back for a long time. And then in the U.S., Johns Hopkins was a crucial place where a lot of this stuff got worked out for the first time, including discovery of anesthesia and things of that sort. Now, of course, the idea that if you have some ailments, that certain drugs can work against them, that goes back to antiquity. And it goes back to antiquity in a variety of different cultures, and very often exactly the same remedies are found. And there were old models of, right, how the body is supposed to work. You already saw the Hippocratic Oath. And with Galen, you had the development of the theory of humors, that body contains this, this, and this. Now, one interesting thing about medicine is that the scientific method where you test a particular claim about the efficacy of some particular treatment, whether a particular drug works against a disease or something like that, that did not enter, and versus a control where you don't do the same thing and see what happens. That does not actually get going until the 19th century, well after the scientific revolution had dominated all kinds of other areas of practice. Once it got going, the crucial advances were first the discovery that some simple hygienic remedies were amazingly important to prevent infectious diseases from spreading. The most important of these, of course, was the case of women suffering from a variety of diseases and dying after childbirth, right? And the discovery was eventually made that if the midwives or the doctors were delivering the babies, right, washed their hands between one case and another, the number of deaths of this kind goes down by about 90%. And then there was a short transition from that to understanding in general that germs, there were some things called germs, that these are the things that cause disease, and then gradually, because of improved microscopy, by the 1860s or 70s, it was clear that these germs were basically tiny living things that had been observed under the microscope going back to the 17th century, right? And then, of course, came the issue of what could you do to kill the germs. And one of the things people found out right from the beginning was that fairly high heat would kill most germs. We know now in the Fahrenheit measure, for example, 160 degrees or 180 degrees, not even the boiling point of water, is sufficient to get rid of most bacteria and ordinary germs, though some can resist that and all of that. Now, one side consequence of the germ theory was, of course, the realization that creating life from non-life was an amazingly difficult thing. Every time people thought that they were seeing examples of spontaneous generation, widespread belief in the early 19th century, if you carried out the so-called pasteurization process following Pasteur, who discovered this, that if you boil the stuff, right, and you wash it with boiling water or you heat it enough, and killed off all the cells that were already... Can this go down? You can do lots of things, but it can't go down, huh? All right. But if you killed all of these things, right, all of the living, so to say, small organisms inside a material, then new organisms did not arise. That's why you could pasteurize wine to prevent it from going bad. And most importantly, by boiling, you could pasteurize dairy products, right? Milk. And as a consequence, milk could stay for longer, it was safer for longer to eat, to drink, and things of that kind. Now, the germ theory probably is the beginning of a scientific approach towards medicine, and that was, of course, followed shortly afterwards by discovering that germs could also be targeted with specific drugs, right? That you could control typhoid by a certain drug, you can control smallpox. Well, smallpox was eliminated by vaccination. You could eliminate a bunch of drugs in this way. Ehrlich, a German physician by the name of Ehrlich, was crucial to that story. His remarkable achievement was to recognize that you could somehow generate a very close fit in shape between a drug and what it targeted. And if the shape was good enough, it was, so to say, a silver bullet. It prevented the disease that was caused by the germ. And by the time you get to the 20th century, this idea that by using a scientific method, medicine would become better and better, and ultimately we'd be able to solve all our health problems. Everybody with me? One natural consequence of all of this was to try to develop a scientific theoretical medicine. Okay? And Bors's program of trying to make the ideas of health and disease purely scientific falls right inside that pattern. Everybody with me? Okay. And the same pattern is also that leads to what nowadays we consider to be evidence-based medicine, leads to the program of personalized medicine, and all the promises that keep on being made coming in from genetics and genomics about how new scientific understanding would change medical practice altogether. When I'm saying all of this, most of you probably think that this is blatantly obvious, that we should be able to do all of this, and why are we worried so much? Is it not recording?
It's about to be. So I have an updated instruction for you.
Okay, yeah.
All you have to do now,
yeah,
when you come in,
yeah,
is just use the microphone. We can turn this off and keep it off.
Okay.
And as long as you are hearing yourself coming in through the speakers,
okay,
you should be good.
All right. Is there any way to turn this down?
I'm sorry?
Is this fixed? Or
it is fixed. I can't aim it down.
You can't aim it down.
I can do that, maybe.
I don't know what good that is. You just... What? Oh, yeah, we can put the table down.
Course,
that's right.
Yeah, we can do that with this right here.
That's what I knew that I didn't have this problem in the last few classes. That's why I'm having this problem today.
Now, all keep right in mind, you must be wearing the microphone in order for it to pick up your voice.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll leave it here for the time being.
Okay.
Can I pick it up now?
Yeah.
All right, anyway, look. So Bors's program is right there. If you can give a purely scientific definition, right, of what health is, and then define disease using that as, say, the absence of health, then you're well on your way towards having a subject that can be dominated and governed by a scientific theory, and that's what medicine is supposed to do. That's the motivation. We're going to be quite critical of what Bors actually achieves in practice, so I want to explain why it was important, and in some sense, had the project fully succeeded, it would have been a very good thing for the medical sciences. Everybody with me? Okay? I mean, and the point to remember here is that the reason why this ambition is important, this is where I was before he came in, is that a lot of things that you do in medicine are correct and were decided by trial and error, but we don't really have a theory behind it. The classic example I like to give over and over again is anesthetics. Everybody knows that they work, and you should be very, very happy that they're around in case you ever need surgery, right? Imagine the days when a surgeon would have to use a hacksaw to cut off your leg, and the best way you can control for pain is by getting thoroughly drunk. That's not exactly the best way to do this, though, to go through it. Anesthesia somehow turns off your central nervous system for a while, right? And you recover from it. But the exact mechanism by which anesthesia works is not known. Okay, and then nowadays, there are tons of things that you accept about the mind-body connection for which we have no theory, but we know it works. The classic one, of course, is relaxation. And in some cases, concentration of certain things, typically practiced under the vague name of meditation, can bring down your heart rate, can bring down your blood pressure. Everybody with me? Okay, and a variety of these other things where the relaxation response and other things have been tried, where we know it works, and in that sense it's completely scientific. We have empirical tested evidence that it works. but we do not have a theoretical understanding in the sense we don't know why it works, okay? What exactly happens at the level of biological or chemical mechanisms that make these things work. Everybody with me? Okay, so that's the program. So now, after Bohr says that contrary to standard practice, he is going to try to attempt a scientific definition of health, and that's not going to depend on social values, societal values, right, about what's desirable and what's not desirable. What is this definition going to be? He's going to try to borrow from biology, and he's going to try to acknowledge individual variation. Anybody want to remind us what exactly are the two criteria Bohr has for health? Yeah. Well, age and sex are the two ways in which he divides up the population. But what is he looking for? Yeah.
Function.
Function is one of them, for sure. And what's the other? I'm sorry? Well, that's going to be the definition. That's going to be the definition. If you don't have health, you have disease. If you don't have disease, you have health. Yeah, you already have that? Statistical normality. Those are the true criteria, right? Now, the moment you say that, look at things that you discover. So take yourself, right? Unless you are either very healthy or rather unhealthy, your pulse rate now should be something between 50 and 100, right? Okay. Anything above 100 is relatively unhealthy, but I'll get back to it whether it really is unhealthy. That's what most physicians would tell you. You should worry a bit if your pulse rate is consistently above 100, right? What do you think the pulse rate is in a newborn baby? What? I'm sorry, can somebody speak up? Everybody's whispering, but nobody wants to really commit themselves to anything. Yeah. What do you think? 140, 160, and all of that. And if you now decide that the newborn baby is unhealthy because it has a pulse rate of over 140, you clearly have made a mistake, right? So how? So you, when this statistical normality and this function cannot refer to the human population as a whole, so one thing that you obviously have taken into account, Bohr's argues, is going to be age class. And let us, for the time being, give him that he can more or less define that properly with clear biological markers. But clear biological markers, one would be up to birth to a certain number of weeks after birth, right? And then childhood to puberty, all kinds of bad things or crazy things happen to you. Your bodies don't function like they will function later on or before. When you reach puberty, right? And that is a specific biological stage, you begin for the first time to acquire what are called secondary sexual characteristics, right? And not just the genitalia, other aspects of the normal body that are related to reproduction. And then when that development of those reproductive faculties is finished, you reach full adulthood. Everybody with me? And of course, you can play around with these names. From a purely biological point of view, the moment you reach reproductive maturity, that is, you have the ability to have offspring, that's the definition of adulthood. Okay? And development, from a purely biological point of view, is everything up to adulthood, is embryological development. And so development does not stop at birth from that perspective. It goes all the way until you enter a population as an reproductive adult. Everybody with me? Okay. But play around with this. So let's not question that part about it. What else is going to matter? Besides age in trying to define normality. Yeah?
Environment?
Well, environment, but that's not internal to you, right? We'll get to that issue about the role played by environment in these definitions. Anything else? Yeah? Sex, right? Okay. And that, he takes the stakes to be... sex. And I'm intentionally using the word sex and not gender. A distinction I'll be maintaining in class is that gender can be socially constructed. Sex is supposed not to be socially constructed. How many sexes are there? Two, really? How do you define that? So you want to give it a definition like a variable geneticist by XX and XY, right? Is that what you're going to do?
What about the other chromosomes, like XXY or XY?
Okay, now comes an issue. Is that actually something that is a separate class, or does it become something that's dysfunctional? Well, let's get to that. But even before you get there, so you put in XX and XY. What tells you that besides, of course, the traditional genetics, outside genetics, that's the appropriate definition of sex? After all, do you think people did not know what sex was before they discovered chromosomes?
Society.
Well, society, but what else? Physically. I'm not asking a deep or hard question. I'm asking a very obvious question. What? Yeah. So the organs, right? And the organs are broadly classified into male and female, right? How good is the match between the genes and the organs? What?
Pretty good,
but that's for sure. But how good? What percentage of the population do you think might be XX and have male characteristics, external characteristics, or be XY and have female external characteristics? A lot is a straightforward answer. Might be a tiny fraction, but huge amounts of people. The exact numbers are particularly hard to get by because people very, and especially in these days when surgical intervention is very, very common in situations like that. But even without that, if you go back and look at cultural coping strategies that people have developed in various cultures around the world, that's a significant number of people, right? Okay. Excluding them and saying you have two sexes in order to define disease and health has some consequences, but aren't these consequences a result of societal values rather some than value-independent science? Everybody with me? For a lot of complicated reasons, most biologists now would say there are seven sexes. I will not try to get into that, but clearly there can obviously be four, right? You can have XX and female characteristics, okay? That's what people take to be normal. But you can have XX and male physical characteristics, and that's a different sex. Everybody with me? Similarly, XY and male is what you commonly see, but you can have XY and external female characteristics, and you automatically have four. Why not divide it into four rather than two? I haven't talked to Boris in decades, and I wonder nowadays, compared to when he was writing some 30 years ago, whether or not he would freely acknowledge this and say, well, yeah, the only way his account has to be modified is that, no, there are not just two sexes, there are four sexes, and so you have four different classes. Everybody with me? In principle, there's nothing that prevents you from modifying it in that way, but it should come as a warning that just as he took it to be obvious 30 years ago that there should be two divisions, right? And we are taking it to be obvious that there are four standard deviations, but I've already told you, some people think there are seven. Every time we're doing something like these are cultural values being imposed. And are the values, the next question you have to ask, what kind of cultural values? One cultural value would be, look, I don't like counting more than four, so I always divide things into no more than four classes. Everybody with me? I like a small finite number, so I see a rainbow. I say a rainbow has seven colors. But some societies say six colors because they treat blue and indigo as the same color. Everybody with me? Okay? Right. But a rainbow really has as many colors as the ways in which you should classify it. But that is, so it is reflective. Something, some social criterion, but it's not a criterion about what's desirable or undesirable, right? Nothing's particularly desirable about 7 over 6 or 6 over 7, at least explicitly to the extent we know what we are doing. Everybody with me? But how about the case of sex? Wasn't a decision
to treat, or one decision could be just, I'll ignore everything else, is the genetics of the situation, right? Just as there are decisions now in a certain political orientation that you're going to ignore all characteristics except physical appearance at birth to determine what the sex of a person would be. So as one of the people who were affected by this recently said that he looked like a hairy monster and he's being told to go into a women's room with young children in it. Just because some state or the other required that people use bathrooms that correspond to their sex at birth. Everybody with me? And couldn't it have been the case that sex male and XY females were being forced into other categories similarly, purely because of cultural values? I'm not using the word prejudices. I'm not trying to pass that kind of a value judgment here. What I'm saying reflects a cultural value about desirability. Everybody with me? Can Bohr's get out of that problem? Yeah? How?
Because he looks at just the biological standpoint of it.
But the question is, aren't the biological categories themselves things that, unlike, say, the colors of a rainbow, embody into them some cultural factors, which can vary from culture to culture? After all, in the case of sex, there used to be, at least until 50 years ago, complete acceptance of these other sexes as different sexes in countries of South Asia. And in fact, with a move that I actually approve of for once, I think last year, the government of India introduced passports in which you could list your sex as male, female, or other. No questions asked. Okay. So aren't these just cultural things about what's desirable and what's not? And if these are cultural things, where does Bohr's program of defining health as being scientific, not value-laden, where does it go? Everybody with me? Okay. All right. Having said that, let's get to the other one. When you're dividing up, so when you have all of these, so what happens when you're taking a particular age group and you regard people that might have very different physiologies? Can you define an appropriate statistical norm? That's the criticism. Where did I write down statistical norm? Somewhere. Yeah. That's the criticism that Kingma makes over and over again. To have a statistical norm or to define, do you use statistics? You have to talk a bit about probabilities, right? Okay. This is the range of variation, and these are the probabilities associated with it. That's why you are going to do something called statistics on them. And probabilities presumably have to be understood in terms of the relative frequency. How much of this type compared to the general population? Everybody with me? Okay? All right. Now, how do you go about doing that? So let me ask you. I take all the positive integers, right? You know what I'm talking about? 1, 2, 3, all the way up. And I pick one at random from them, right? What's the probability that it's even? Nobody's going to answer because we're all worried there's a trick here. 50% is what he's, that's a natural answer, right? How would you defend it? If you have a bigger and bigger set, right, of numbers available to you as your sample, and you pick one, you're going to converge closer and closer to the norm, right? And if I write down my positive integers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and on, you clearly see that as the set gets bigger and bigger, as a limit to the frequency of evens versus all, right, or odds versus all, I will converge to the number 0.5, right? Okay, everybody with me? So now I will come back and write it in the following way. 1, 2, 4, 3, 6, 8, 5, 10, 11,
I draw number for it. And the first thing to convince yourself, if I write out that sequence indefinitely, right, I will have all the positive integers. Everybody with me? I'm just clumping some together as I write them down. Now, if I pull a number out of there, what's the probability that it is going to be even? Well, two-thirds, right? For because for every odd number I see two evens. Everybody with me?
In other words, when you're defining a reference class to say what the probability of something is, right, you have to worry about lots of things. Okay, you have to worry first on what the reference class is.
If my reference class had been all real numbers, including fractions and things of this sort, right, and then irrational numbers like pi, square root of 2, and all of that, the probability that any number I pick out is even, is even, or even an integer, is zero, even though I know there's an infinite number of even numbers. But not only does it depend on what the reference class is composed of, it depends on how the reference class is presented. Okay. So you have to be extremely careful when you're talking about statistical norms that your reference class is chosen correctly and presented correctly. Everybody with me? In the case of medical properties, can this be done in a way that is not circular and therefore value-ridden? So, I want to find out if your blood pressure is normal. So I go around and I choose as reference classes in such a way that you will have, your blood pressure turns out to be the average of that particular reference class. Everybody with me? So I divide up my age class into 2 years to 3 years, then up to 8 years, then up to 17 years, then up to 60 years. And I go through with that and I'll give you a completely circular definition of how the reference class should be, the age classes should be, right? And I'm ensured through that that you are about average or you're not very far from the average. But it's completely circular. Everybody with me? And it's governed by the norm that your blood pressure should be a particular value. In the old days, people used to worry both about high blood pressure and low blood pressure. Nowadays, for good or for bad, physicians no longer worry about low blood pressure at all. They think if the blood pressure is high enough to be able to get from your heart to your head or your feet, that's good enough. After that, it doesn't matter. It's only high blood pressure that worries them, what they call hypertension. Everybody with me? Somebody had a hand up in the back. Anybody? Okay. All right. And the question now is that are all these categories going to be like that? And you know, you really have to be careful about these because it's just this claim that we can define exact classes and this is completely neutral is sort of silly. I mean, I myself went through a weird experience when I first moved to this country after having until then grown up very high in the Himalayas at 8,000 feet. And until I went to college at Columbia, I'd never had a complete physical. And when I first got my complete physical, they were immediately going to send me off to get me tested for all kinds of weird blood cancers, because my hemoglobin content was 178% of what the normal was supposed to be. And so before I actually went and admitted myself to this hospital where they would keep me for a couple of days and do all kinds of things that seemed to be quite unpleasant, I decided to call up a Tibetan doctor who was living in Brooklyn and tell him what exactly was going on, just for not any other reason. I was looking for somebody who came from a very similar cultural background. And the Tibetan doctor said, why don't you just tell them you grew up at 8,000 feet? You're normal. The body compensates by making more hemoglobin because there's less oxygen in the atmosphere. And this will remain with you for 10 years or so and will sort of decline. So I went back and I convinced my doctor that this might be what was happening. And he went back and read old physiology texts and finally very reluctantly accepted that there was nothing abnormal about my hemoglobin. And there was no point to try to test me for all these complicated cancers. And he was completely right. And you know, and I kept on measuring myself every few years. And about 10 years later, it did disappear when I no longer needed that extra hemoglobin because of an ample oxygen in some form or the other available to me. And the point is that how many of these normal categories get defined without looking at the environment. Somebody was pointing out about the environment, the environmental peculiarities of what these things are. Everybody with me? Okay. And some of these, of course, will be value-laden, but they're all culturally-laden. They're all going to be value-laden culturally. Some, because of normative reasons about what's desirable or not, and otherwise not. Okay? Next comes the issue of function. Versus our position takes it for granted that we have a good idea of what function is, right? And that we inherit from biology. Now, in biology itself, there is one very obvious notion of function. Something that you have in your body, or any organism has in its body, right, is functional if it helps maintain or enhance fitness. That's what we get from the theory of evolution. Everybody with me? Okay. What does fitness mean? It's the ability to reproduce. It's measured. Not defined, but measured by the expected number of offspring, and that's what makes something functional. If something does not contribute towards fitness, then it is not functional. That's one obvious sense, right? Are you happy with that? Everybody with me? Are there situations in which you would say something is functional? But that would not satisfy that? Yeah.
Getting their tube side or centimeter.
Yeah, but then Bohr would happily come and say that is non-functional behavior. Remember, Bohr does not think that diseases are undesirable. I emphasized this point last time. He wants a concept of disease and a health that have no values associated with them. Yeah. But he doesn't have health. That's a separate question for him. Is the purpose of medicine is to get health, okay? Or if it's health. But whether you want to do it or not is a different question. So it's sort of almost like deciding the degree of health you have is like deciding your weight. Right? You know, weight might be something like that. Or deciding something else, right? That has no social consequences or other consequences. It's supposed to be completely value independent. Yeah?
Being able to smell pleasant things.
Does that enhance fitness? It might. There are two things, obviously. It might. I'm not saying it does. It might. One of them is that the aversion to horrible smelling things that even babies have, right, is maybe an aversion towards eating things that are unhealthy for you because they're rotting or things of that sort. Right? Yeah. I can't hear you. I'm not sure I understand. Well, cosmetic surgery. Yeah, you get to all of that. Look, with the smell situation, it's also there are other weird things that are going on, which is that we have over the last 40 years begun to realize that a lot of olfactory communication is quite important to humans. Whether it enhances fitness is harder to say. One crucial one, of course, is the response by which women manage, if they're living in closed settings, to synchronize their menstrual cycles. And there can be endless arguments as to whether that's functional or not. Yeah, you had your hand up? Really makes life complicated in an interesting way. But I was looking for a simpler example. Take any female of any species, any mammal species that's post-reproductive. Okay? Say this female is alive, right, and has a beating heart.
What's the function of the heart? How does it increase fitness? It's a kind of animal in which that doesn't happen at all. That there's no, it's a completely non-social animal. You might make that case for humans, you might make that case for lions, but by and large you can't make that, take tigers, no social life of that kind at all. Yeah. Yeah, that's the same example that he was giving. But take about animals in which all, right, care that happens to be from the parents and not from grandparents and others. Or take others in which virtually there's no care at all. Care disappears very, very early. Antelopes get born and within a few seconds can get up and run. We humans are pretty horrible that way. So how number of years we require care before we can do anything by ourselves. Somebody else, you had a hand up? Yeah.
I think the most straightforward answer is that from this force functional point of view, the heart of the post reproductive female is there's not really much of a function for it.
Yeah, this is not the Bohr's point of view, but that's what I was getting at. From the evolutionary point of view. Yeah. They may, but they may also may not. They may take goats. Presumably they're the worst thing after cats to ever introduce into an ecosystem, right? I mean, but humans are pretty bad too. But cats have done more harm to other species than any other species, primarily bird species, because feral cats have done incredible damage to exemplars of cats. That's it. And after that, the species that does the greatest damage is goats. And in both cats and goats, there is no caring across generations, several generations. There's just caring, parental care, and that's it. There's no familial care, no grandparental care. I mean, the lesson to learn from all of this is that the evolutionary definition of fitness is, our definition of function on the basis of fitness is probably too narrow for everything we want to consider called functional, right? So very often when you add to that is sort of a notion that it maintains the living organism. And you can say both of these are goal-directed but not value-laden, or if it is value-laden at all, it's very minimal in the sense that when we are talking about living things, we're talking about them as living things. So the persistence of life, it's part of what that system is. Everybody with me? Okay. You might be able to get away with it. But then, what's functional? And now somebody talked about having sex for purposes other than reproduction. What function does that play? Yeah.
Well, when it increases the chances that you're going to reproduce, you can try to use some contraception, it may not work. And secondly, healthy for you to do to maintain good.
How is that applicable to homosexual sex?
Well, the second part of that would, because by having sex, they'd be living more healthy physical and mental lives, so they're better at.
What's the evidence for that?
I read a headline.
That's a good one. A nice, very socially desirable headline that you do all the things that you're normally supposed to be, and that's healthy for you. It's one of those great ones, right? Is that so much, and partly, of course, all of you are playing a standard game that everybody plays, which is coming up with just those stories when things really cannot be made sense of in terms of just natural selection operating everywhere. And one of the great things about it is that everybody's arguments always seems to assume that the human societies are organized as nuclear families with parents living with just their children in a separate household. And nobody seems to realize that the nuclear family only arose in the 1950s in the US and spread to some cultures outside. It's not the standard pattern of human habitation, never has been in our history.
And then when people build all of that in, to somehow suggest that all of this is going to maintain bonding and all kinds of arguments like that, what it's supposed to do. But the core point over here is neither persistence, right, nor any ordinary notion of well-being that is applicable to the physical body, nor reproduction, is going to explain the varieties of sexual behavior that humans indulge in.
Okay.
Or bonobos. I mean, we bonobos and us are about the only primate species that really have made a sharp distinction between sex and reproduction. Lots of other, most of the mammals don't do it at all. Everybody with me? Okay. And what's Borsa's response? He's perfectly willing, actually, to call homosexuality dysfunctional. And remember, he's not willing to say that's a bad thing. He just thinks lots of things we do are disease things, but so what? Just because something is a disease, certainly for him, does not mean that we should try to do anything to treat it. Everybody with me? Okay. And the question then is that really in any sense the notion of health and disease that either medicine uses or should use? Certainly, nobody, I mean, this is a long time back, and Bors fought a very long and vigorous philosophical battle to get this going. And by and large, what has happened is that particular project of theoretical medicine has been left aside. I mean, there is some acceptance that not only is it unlikely for a while to have that kind of a value-independent medicine, we should, trying to do so is a waste of time. We should acknowledge that we are in a situation where this is a value-laden process and be quite explicit about arguing what our values are and more often with the values, what the values should be, right? And we in our society right now are playing that kind of game as we are becoming more and more aware and trying to decide whether we should be more accepting about varieties of sexual identity and sexual preference, right, which go well beyond the XX female and the XY male. Okay. What are we supposed to make sense of biologically of somebody saying that he or she is trapped in a body of a different sex, and therefore that sex itself should be malleable? For some people, this is deeply offensive. For others, it's no different than wearing glasses to get your eyes work properly. Everybody with me? Okay. But the point is that the answer to this probably cannot come on scientific grounds. By being explicit about all of this, we have a discussion of what our societal values should be and how they should change. Remember, societal values do evolve. They're not static, right? You go back a couple of hundred years, and lots of the world thought that slavery was just fine, right? Including people who wrote the American Constitution. Some of the people who wrote the American Constitution. So values evolve, and the question is in what direction we should make it evolve. And by now, of course, you should also realize values don't always evolve in ways that you think is right, no matter what your political persuasion is, right? At the one end, there'll be people saying, all this acceptance and liberalism about sexual orientation is a horrible thing, and so values are evolving in the wrong direction. And the other end, there'll be people saying, well, the rise of Trump is a horrible thing, and so values are also evolving in a wrong direction. So the point over here is this is contested territory, and you have to argue your way through it. Everybody with me? Okay? All right. So the response, of course, that you read to Bors, you read the Kingma response, right, where he comes out and says this is a project that cannot be done. The way in which we choose the reference classes inevitably brings up, right, and incorporates social societal values about what we consider desirable and what we consider undesirable. Any questions about that? Has everything been clear? Okay. If I've not made Bors's motivation absolutely as compelling as you would like it to be, it probably is my fault, because at the end of the day, I really don't see why he was so completely caught up in this idea that everything has to be done without recourse to values, because somebody like me, right from the beginning, accepts that things like medicine have values incorporated in them. But other than that, have things been clear so far about Bors and the Kingma exchange? Right. All right. And then comes your reading for today. Mark Reshevsky was the reading for today, right? Over there. Who is a straightforward, ordinary philosopher of biology. And he takes a lot of time to point out the obvious. First, he wants to make a distinction between what can be measured and what cannot. And that gives you state values, right? Later on, we will worry about the measurability problem, right? When people, in the 1990, famous 1990 article, a group of psychologists from the University of Minnesota decided to publish an article based on studying identical twins to say that religiosity was inherited through the genes, right? And in the process, they had numbers to measure religiosity. All my life, I've regarded that as a really funny thing. The idea that you can put a number between 1 and 6 to how religious you are. These are meaningless numbers. And in fact, the real issue then is are these numbers any more meaningless than saying you can measure intelligence by a quotient, which also strikes me as being really silly. That someone can give you an IQ score and tell you that that's a measure of your intelligence. And then if you really take that logic to the extreme, IQ scores today are 20% higher than they were in the 1920s. So we are, no, 50% higher than they were in the 1920s. And so we as a society are 50% brighter than people like Einstein and others who created modern physics. You believe me, you should then, I guess what you should look for a job in the Trump administration. So we will worry about measurability later as to what it conceivably could mean, but that's not at stake. Some things clearly can be. I can measure the carbon dioxide content of your blood. I can measure the oxygen content of your blood. I can measure fairly easily your hypertension. I can measure the amount of uric acid in different parts of your body and all of that. And then separate these out completely from discussions of how desirable is a particular state and treat the norms and ordinary measurement things as independent things that have to be determined. Yeah, another question?
Do you see any value in the way hospitals ask you to measure your severe pain?
I see some heuristic value, as long as you don't take it too seriously. So if you come out and say it's only 2, they might feel they don't really have to treat you. If you say it's 10, they probably think that there's a possibility because it's partly psychological, the person might go into shock. So I see heuristic that. But if then you went and think that, well, he says 5 and that person says 4, right, therefore that person is in less pain than this person, then it becomes very silly. All right, let's stop here and come back on Thursday. Yeah.
So I did a deeper read at the syllabus, and I noticed a lot of people using computers, and I prefer to take notes at computers, so I was wondering, what...
Who's using computers?
It was just, I see laptops.
They're not supposed to be using it. If they do, then they will automatically fail. I didn't notice them, so...
Okay.
Yeah.